Bon, bonjour à toutes et à tous. Donc, merci d'être venus au premier cours de cette série que va nous donner Andrea Cavalleri. Je vais passer à l'anglais, tout le monde peut se comprendre. So, Andrea, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Collège de France. Let me say that Andrea is going to be visiting us for a month. So there will be plenty of opportunity to connect to him if you want to have discussions with him about science and whatever else. He's going to give a series of four lectures, but in three installments. So the first one is today, and it will be focused on experimental tools and techniques in non-equilibrium incandescent matter physics. The second one is on Thursday, February 9th, so next week, and this will be nonlinear quantum plasmonics. Correct me if you have changed some of the topics, no, still that. And the last two lectures, so there is a 1 week break, and the last two lectures will take place on Thursday, February 23rd, and it will be about two big topics, nonlinear phononics and light-induced superconductivity. So I hope you will be able to follow all the lectures, and we are really looking forward to that. So let me tell you a few things about Andrea, just to embarrass him before he starts. So when you ask Andrea what his training was like, he says that he was trained by the royalties of laser physics, and he quotes three people, Dietrich von der Linde, with whom he did his PhD in Essen, Kent Wilson, a memorable postdoc at UCSD, and Charles Schenck at Lawrence Berkeley. And Lawrence Berkeley is particularly important, I guess, because this is where you started this great work about controlling lattice modes and phonons with parallax pumps. Another important piece of work that Andrea did also, I think, back at the same time, is time-resolved observation of the crystal lattice, and when we discussed this earlier today, you mentioned that that was in competition with people from LOR in Paliso. Okay, so there were these two great things, and of course, more recently, a very interesting and stimulating piece of research that Andrea has been doing has been light-induced superconductivity, both in the cuprates and more recently in the fullerenes. I'm sure we're going to hear about that. So I'm not going to, of course, since then, since the Berkeley times I was mentioning, Andrea went to Oxford, where he was a lecturer, and then eventually to the Max Planck in Hamburg, where he founded the new Max Planck Institute in Hamburg, which is the Max Planck Institute for Structural Dynamics. What else should I say? A few personal things. How do I know this guy? So actually, we first met, I think, at some PIPT, photo-induced phase transition conference, a very nice series of conferences in Osaka, Japan. And Andrea was giving one of these beautiful talks on nonlinear phononics, and I thought, who is this guy? So that was very exciting. But then a few years later, he actually contacted me saying, do you want to participate in some ERC synergy proposal? And I said, why not, provided you teach me something about ultra-fast, because I know nothing, so I'm not sure what help I can be here. But, you know, it worked out pretty nicely. I'm learning a lot. One thing I learned about Andrea is that if you want to understand what he's saying, you better know nonlinear optics, because he has this talent for converting any condensed matter concept into the language of nonlinear optics. So if I want to understand what he's saying, I have to understand a little bit about nonlinear optics, otherwise we can't talk. So, you know, without, I should also mention a few of the numerous distinctions he got, but there are two which are particularly dear to his heart, besides getting the ERC synergy, of course, that goes without saying, the Max Born Medal and the Danny Heinemann Prize given by Göttingen Academy of Science, right? So I'm not going to embarrass Andrea further with listing all his claim to fame and distinctions. Let me just say that both scientifically and on a personal level, I'm very, very happy that he can visit us for a month. And he's going to talk to us today about experimental techniques. So I'm going to learn a lot. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Antoine, for this introduction. Thank you all for coming. This was definitely very embarrassing, so I didn't really know where to look. So let's see. So I'm going to give four lectures here during my stay this month, and this is going to be this is a very strange thing to put together. I will tell you about optical techniques for condensed matter, and so the way this talk is organized is that people that know about anything about what I'm going to say are going to get no information out of this because it's going to be at such a superficial level that it will be quite embarrassing. People that do not know about this will learn nothing because there's really no content. Somehow the purpose of this talk is that when you at the end of this lecture, if you hear OPA, you will know what it is. And if you hear DFG, you will know what that means. But that's about it. But I will try to give you a little bit of a view of the way new experimental techniques in optical science are making it possible to do new experiments, and how the field is developing at such a high speed that we are, at least the technical aspects of the field are developing at such a high speed that we are now able to think about experiments that we could not do before. And let's see where we go. So I will tell you at the beginning, I will motivate a little bit about experiments in quantum condensed matter, and I will give very, very basic concepts even there. And sort of lead you into this technical aspect. As Antoine mentioned, the next talks are going to be a bit more about serious issues. So they'll probably have a little more interesting or sort of insightful things about the condensed matter physics. Okay, so the first word you found in my title, or the second, or whatever, one of the keywords is quantum condensed matter. Quantum materials, the concept of quantum condensed matter is one of those words that people use, and it's never really clear what they mean when they say quantum materials. My own interpretation of quantum materials is the following. Quantum materials are a group of solids in which one cannot even qualitatively describe the physics or describe their collective behavior by using classical physics. I mean, everybody knows that you need quantum mechanics to understand why silicon is silicon and it has a band gap rather than not having a band gap, or why something is a metal and why something is an insulator. But perhaps one qualitatively could decide that you can tell why something is an insulator because, say, the electrons are stuck close to the nuclei, whereas something is a metal because the electrons are itinerant. And if I think about a metal and I try to decide why does a metal conduct and how does it conduct, although I cannot quantitatively predict how well it conducts, I can kind of, by basic, if I put a scattering rate and some density of electrons, I can do a pretty good job at understanding how good of a metal it is. But there's a number of things that I can't do. One of them is predict why a superconductor is a superconductor. So a superconductor is a state of matter in which electrons, or the charge carriers, acquire exactly zero resistance below a particular temperature, and they have a specific behavior in magnetic field that cannot be predicted in any ways by using classical physics. Some people will argue that many other effects in which every time I need to sort of consider, there's many other examples of this. But this is my interpretation of what a quantum material is. The other thing that we will be thinking of are effects in quantum materials in which the physics, the interaction between the many electrons becomes important. So this is something that I've stolen from Antoine. Antoine likes to say that quantum materials do big things. They do big things because the electrons are very strongly interacting with one another. Hence, these systems are many of these materials that I will not tell you anything about today are highly nonlinear systems, which have many competing states, many competing ground states, that are very susceptible to external stimuli. And this is another things that I've learned how to copy from Antoine's lectures, is that the materials with strong interactions are the ones that hesitate between multiple ground states. In a sense, these could be an insulator with some magnetic order, or almost equally easily, they could be a metal with another type of magnetic order. And this has got to do with the fact that the system is very highly nonlinear. And this is, and all these functionalities can be also functionally relevant. So in a sense that one could think about switching these properties between one or the other state. And in a sense, that's why they're very interesting. So they're not only interesting because we don't really understand them and they have all these very beautiful physics, but also because in principle, some of these functionalities could be used to make devices. And so this is one of the reasons why we study them. Let's see. So this is how I'm going to summarize this at a very simple level. Strong correlations produce collective giant responses of these materials to small external perturbations. These are functionally relevant responses. And what we would like to do is to control these materials and make them do what we want. And mind you, the same reason that makes them so susceptible and so interesting is also the reason why they're so difficult to control. So these two things go hand in hand. In principle, a system that is infinitely sensitive to external stimulation is also the hardest to be controlled. And this is why these phase diagrams have, you know, are so crazy. And this is, what do I show there? I show some manganites and various other compounds in which this multiplicity of ground states is especially important. Okay. So this is really, again, in the spirit of a talk with no content, this is what I'm going to tell you. So for maybe 100 years or more, maybe for thousands of years, people have been trying to control these materials by doing the followings. One of this is a phase diagram. Is there? Yeah, there you go. I'm learning how to use glasses. I don't know where to look. So this is a phase diagram of one particular material. And what one does is one changes the composition of these materials. This is by alloying these materials in different ways. One can change the stoichiometry of the various chemical components, and one can change the chemical doping. So this is some sort of materials design axis. One can heat them up or cool them down, or one can apply slow perturbations, such as squashing the materials with pressure, or applying a magnetic field, or applying an electric field, and one can try to control them. And this is, again, this is the basis of our way to control their properties and discover new phenomena, discover new materials, etc. What we're very interested in doing is to use, and this is where the optics and the ultrafast comes, is to use dynamical perturbations. So the questions that we ask are not, what can I do if I squash these materials or if I do something slowly, but what can I do if I do something fast and dynamically? And you know, this is something that may look not very well controlled. So this is there's ways to do this intelligently, this is a depiction of a bilayer cupric superconductor. And one of the questions that one can ask is, what happens if I take this material at, say, zero temperature, which has one particular state, and then I take 1 degree of freedom, for example, a phonon, and I shake it up and down and to large amplitudes, and then what are the properties of the system? And it's known that driven systems, there you go, have different properties from equilibrium systems. This is a normal pendulum, which has one stable minimum and an unstable minimum at theta equal pi. And now if I simulate the behavior of a pendulum, and what I do is I shake the pivot point of this pendulum up and down, what one finds, not only one can find different energetic configurations, and on average I could find, for example, an equilibrium point here in the theta equal pi state. This is an example in which dynamical modulation can change the energy landscape. And in principle, why not? Why can't one do this into in a condensed matter system? Another example of why dynamical phenomena can change the energy landscape is simply one in which I consider a settle point potential. So this could be a situation in which I have, for example, an ion in the middle of a quadrupolar of quadrupoles, and this is an unstable settle point unless I make the an unstable minimum maximum unless I make the settle point spin fast. And if I make this spin fast, what I will create is an effective minimum of potential. So these are two trivial examples in which one can think of dynamically driven systems, importantly in which the dynamics happens at a speed that is fast compared to the eigenfrequency of whichever instability I'm worried about. So in the if I think about the pendulum, it will have a particular frequency, and if I shake it slow compared to this frequency, I will get sidebands in the spectrum. But if I shake it fast, I will create, in some anti-adiabatic limit, I will create new minima. Okay? So this is why we want to excite systems fast. And so all the experiments I'm going to tell you about today, or what is done in dynamical condensed matter, are ones in which I take a system, so this is some solid in some state, and then I will come with a pump pulse, which may be short or may be long, and this will create a dynamical state of the system. And then I will have a second pulse that samples the dynamics of the system along the relaxation path. So the lifetime of this state might be long, might be short. I could be trapped in a metastable state, which stays there for a long time, or it could be a short-lived state. So you should take this as a very, very general way of thinking about this. And the whole business of ultra-fast science is about using pulses that pump the system in intelligent ways, and then probe pulses, which are weak and therefore measure just they're not supposed to perturb the system, but they're supposed to interrogate the system in an insightful way. Okay? And the duration of these two pulses allows me to measure dynamics on more or less short time scales. So let's see. The pump. So the pump is the whole experiment. In a sense, there's a lot of emphasis on the probe. A lot of people that do optics want to probe states in more and more intelligent ways. But unless you have a very interesting pump that can create an interesting state to probe, it makes no sense to have. And so this is, it makes no sense to have a very advanced probe if you use a very advanced probe to probe something that is not interesting. So a pump probe. I am one of the people that believes that the pump is the whole is everything we should worry about in ultrafast science. Okay, so let's see. Let's think about the driving frequency for the pump that one can think of. So I'm going to classify those driving frequencies in let's say at least in three groups. One group is one where I use near, let's say, visible radiation. So these are petahertz type excitations, say about 1 eV type of excitations, which is about 15,000 Kelvin. And these are typically electronic excitations between bands in the correlated electron systems. This may or may not be, you know, maybe simple bands or complex many body bands, but these will be excitations that are very large on the energy scale of room temperature. Then, you know, in the middle, in the mid infrared to terahertz, there are excitations where I can drive phonons or other complex excitations. And at long wavelengths, around about 1 terahertz, so 1 terahertz is about 4 milliV, or about 50 Kelvin. And these are collective modes, for example, order parameter type excitations of superconductors or various things. And these are sort of many of the things that I would like to do. So in the early days, when people used light at short time scales to measure the dynamics. So this is what I grew up with. I think I'm one of the last people that did his PhD with a dye laser. So these are liquid lasers in which one would dissolve a particular dye in some solvent. And these were very, you know, they would generate weak pulses. These were unstable. They just, you know, you'd align them all day. And then when all the balls were in the air, you take data for 2 hours or many hours overnight, and then they would never, it could never be reproducible. But these were the first lasers that allowed us to have femtosecond radiation, but they were stuck at about 2 eV radiation. Okay, and so a lot of the work that was done in the early days, these were important, for example, in chemistry, because chemists are interested in photochemistry. And the 2 eV energy scale in chemistry is a very meaningful energy scale, because it's one, for example, over which one vision develops photosynthesis works. And, you know, there's many processes that happen in chemistry on relatively high energy scales. Whereas in condensed matter, you know, one may or may not be interested in some of these things. But most of the early work was focused on excitations in this range. Okay, so excitations that are high on the scale of room temperature. Nevertheless, there's been a lot of work. So these are two beautiful experiments of photoinduced phase transitions done in the early 80s by Chuck Schenk, who was at Bell Labs at the time, and he was developing the first amplified dye lasers. This is the inventor of the femtosecond laser, and he was, for example, interested in studying how fast a piece of silicon can melt. These were the first experiments in which they could time, this is probably a second harmonic measurement, and this is a reflectivity measurement, in which they could time the transition between an insulator between a crystal and a liquid state. And this was also interesting for reasons because people wanted to anneal these crystals, et cetera, et cetera. But at any rate, so there's many things that one would have liked to do at longer wavelengths and at lower energies that were not possible to be done. The situation technically has been radically changed with the invention of the titanium sapphire laser. So the titanium sapphire laser is a laser that is built on, these are doped sapphires. Sapphires with titanium in it. These are lasers that radiate. They're solid-state lasers. They radiate at about 1.5 eV, but they can be amplified in this very beautiful way. So this is the most important thing about these lasers is the invention, again, by a Frenchman, by Gérard Mourou, who in the mid-80s, when he was at Rochester, invented a technique that allowed us to generate stable, reliable, high-intensity pulses that, you know, you come in the morning and they work every day, and not only, but they can be amplified by many orders of magnitude, at many, many orders of magnitude higher than what was possible with dye lasers, okay? And so all of a sudden, all sorts of nonlinear optical techniques became possible. This technique, I'm just gonna say two qualitative words about this. You get a short pulse at about, say, 2 eV in a short pulse. And if you want to amplify this pulse, what people did before this type of technique, they would put this pulse in an amplifier, they would amplify it, and before you know it, they would drill the amplifying medium. So they could never drive these pulses to very large amplitudes. What Girard came up with was a technique that allowed to use pairs of gratings and lenses to stretch the pulses. So they would chirp the pulses. They would put, you know, these have a lot of bandwidth. So they have some, say, some red and some blue. You can chirp those pulses, putting them in a grating. Chirp, so they become like or up or down chirped. And so now these pulses would become long. They could be amplified without drilling the amplifier, and they could be recompressed with gratings. And so this has brought these you know, few microjoule pulses to the millijoule, many millijoule joule level. And so there's really a lot of activity and a lot of work. You know, this work was done in the US, but of course the LOE group has done, you know, unbelievable work in many, many areas applying these amplified pulses. Okay? So
Andre, just a naive question. So I understood the chirped idea.
Yeah.
Where does the amplification come from?
Same thing. What you do is you take a piece of titanium sapphire, so you have an amplified pulse, you chirp it, this becomes a long pulse. Then you have a second piece of titanium sapphire, which you excite with another green laser, which is some morally similar to the one that you use to launch the pulses at the beginning. Then you can amplify, the pulse is going this way. From a small pulse is going this way, gets a big pulse, but it's long. So the peak field is never too high. And then you use reflective gratings I will actually show something else that will be later on that will make it clearer. How you can sort of out chirp and then chirp it back, and then in air you end up with this really large, long pulse. You know, however, the whole art of this was to find a way to stretch the pulses. Of course, people tried to do this for a long time, But actually, this was not Girard's doing, but other people figured out a way how to use intelligent lenses so that one could invert the colors in the right way, so that one could make both stretchers and compressors. Yeah, please do stop me because, and also, I don't know most of you. I actually don't know how much you know. I'm sure there's a mixed group of people that know all these things and people that don't. So I'll, the more you talk to me, the more I'm going to be able to say something useful. Okay, at any rate, you can make these pulses, and all of a sudden, you have access to nonlinear optics. These pulses are now stable, and they can be put in nonlinear crystals, and the frequency can be converted. Okay, so these are two plots. This is a titanium sapphire laser that goes into a piece of glass, and it goes from being a narrow one color pulse to this beautiful white light that then is put on a grating, and see, you have these rainbows. This was done 25 years ago in Milan. I think this is a group. This is an experiment that was done in Milano just as a demonstration for some donor or something. This is actually an experiment that was done at the University of Michigan by Girard's group. Maybe Antoine knows this better than I do, but I think this was Girard's lab at the University of Michigan. And what he has done is he has launched these femtosecond lasers down the hall. And what happens is in these pulses is that as the pulse is so intense that as it propagates in air, what it does is that the index of refraction of air is different in the center of the beam and outside of the center of the beam, which leads to some sort of phase self-focusing of the beam. So the beam doesn't diffract out, and it can propagate. People try to make lidars and all sorts of applications, for example, for atmospheric applications using these techniques. Okay, so these are just two examples of what these high intensity pulses let you do. Okay, so this was before my time, but you know, and also I don't do LIDAR. What I'm very interested in is to go back. This is now that when I showed you a plot of all the possible excitations in condensed matter that one is interested in, and again, this is when I did my PhD. We were only exciting here. This is a 1 eV excitation, which is 10,000 wave numbers. And this is, whereas, you know, this is a plot of optical response of complex materials. And you have all sorts of very interesting complex excitations that rather than observing, everybody for a century has been using linear response to measure these excitations close to equilibrium. What I'm interested in is to drive them hard and understand their nonlinear response. Okay, and during this, so this is all this region of frequency and energy. And during these lectures, I will tell you about the nonlinear response, not today, but next week and at the end of the month, about the nonlinear response of vibrations, so these are these phonons, and about the nonlinear response of specific superconducting orders at low frequencies in Cuprate superconductors. Okay. So with this plan in mind, we're still thinking only about the pump. I haven't told you anything about the probe. And I'm going to give you a little bit of trivial ideas of what one does with well-behaved laser pulses to convert them from this color to all these colors down here. Okay? So, and I promise that you are going to get out of this lecture and knowing what OPA means and DFG means. So these are the two plans. Okay, let's see. This is a piece of some material. And the way I think about, in optics, I think about the light that propagates and is generated by a material is by saying that, so forget all these terms, when the fields are weak, I say that the polarization is linearly proportional to a quantity which we call chi. So this is epsilon minus one, effectively. This is chi plus one equals the dielectric constant, yeah? And so what this means, in simple terms, is that if I come in with two wavelengths, omega 1, one is red, and omega 2, the other one is blue, what I get out is exactly the same number of photons, I mean reflection and absorption notwithstanding. I'm going to get out another frequency at omega 1 and another frequency at omega 2. And there is no crosstalk between the two. Okay? If I now think about a field that becomes relatively large on some scale, I'm actually not sure how I would say. Let's say that the field becomes of order such that the material starts responding nonlinearly. then I can start thinking about all the other expansion of this polarizability, and let's only think about the second order polarizability. That's all we're going to need to convert this light into other colors. And so what I can get are a number of other processes that involve, for example, omega 1 plus omega 2. I get omega 1, I get 2 omega 1, 2 omega 2, everything which comes with sums and differences between the two. And so this is SFG, sum frequency generation. What I will have is that I can take omega 1 and omega 1 and omega 2. And because of this term, I can mix them and I can get out a photon at the sum frequency, okay? But because the system has time reversal invariance, I can also have the time reversal symmetric of this, which means I can have difference frequency generation, which means I come in with a pump frequency, which is now, let's say, this frequency, and I can come out with two frequencies that are, let's say, that this nonlinear material is going to be what we call a photon cutter. I have a high frequency photon and I make two, the sum of which are the same energy of the one that comes in, etc. But I can also use this method to amplify this light field. Okay? So this is what OPA is, optical parametric amplification. Okay? So the important thing is that I come with an intense high frequency laser pulse, and I can either spontaneously or I can seed this process, I can get two photons at lower frequencies that are being amplified. So this is a parametric process that allows me to generate lower frequency light. Okay, so this is a simple idea of this. I start with a pump field at high frequency and I get two photon fields. One that I, for various reasons, I called a signal, and one that I call an idler, because traditionally this would be a spectator that would just assist you in amplifying. It would be idle, I suppose, as the signal was being amplified, okay? The great thing about this is that there's no real levels. This is only goes through virtual levels. And so in principle, I can amplify whichever pairs of colors I want. I start from the red, and I could, you know, provided that something happens that I'm gonna tell you, I can generate all pairs of colors. And the other thing that needs to happen is that I need to conserve energy, of course, because the sum of these frequencies needs to be, the sum of these frequencies time h, whatever, needs to be the incoming frequency. But also, I should conserve the phase, which means that I have these two waves that propagate, and these for the light field to build up. The phase velocity of these two fields needs to be matched. Okay, so. So this turns out in this beautiful equation that tells me what I can do, okay? But to the extent that I can match the phase velocities of all these three beams, which of course will have different linear dispersions, so I can play with polarization and various other things to make those guys match, I can build all these parametric amplifiers. Okay? Now the next thing, which is the last thing about nonlinear optics that I'm going to tell you in some detail, is that once I have generated this OPA, which then where I have a signal and an idler, and the signal is being amplified and the idler is also an intense beam, I can now use difference frequency generation to do this minus this and generate even longer wavelengths. Okay, so I can cascade these processes, because typically, because I need to match the wave velocities, typically, this signal and this idler will work well when they're about the same. They are at about the same frequency, but in principle, I can take this and this and then subtract them again and make a very long wavelength. Okay, so this is kind of the basis. All these techniques have been around since the 60s, of course, since people discovered nonlinear optics. But now, with good lasers, we can do lots of things. Right. Okay. One of the things that one can do, and I won't belabor this too much, one can, for example, and this goes back to a little bit to Antoine's question before, I can shape those pulses. For example, I have now let's say that I have generated by matching the group velocity and, the phase velocity of these beams and the energies, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to make a pulse at this difference frequency, which is at, say, 10 microns, and this pulse will not have necessarily the spectrum that I want, will not necessarily have the chirp that I want. I mean, there's many things that one might want to improve. One of the things I can do is use various techniques, again, which have been using visible optics, to shape those pulses. One of the ways we've done this, and again, without discovering anything new, has been to use a combination of a grating, which spreads all the colors into a Fourier plane here, and then a retroreflector, which then changes the time at which different colors are retroreflected, and hence reconstruct the field that comes out with the desired shape that we want. So in principle, what I can do is, you know, I can make a train of pulses. I can make a pulse where the blue comes first, the red comes, you know, in principle I can shape in this plane both the amplitude and the phase of these pulses to give a Fourier filter of the properties of these. Another thing that I can do is I can use the shape pulses. This is now getting a little much, but for example, if this is my signal and this is my idler in some phase space where here is omega and here's the time of arrival, I can move them in phase space in order to get difference frequency with a very, very narrow pulse. So this is, for example, one paper that my student Bialong Liu has recently developed, in which we generate many microjoule relatively high intensity pulses with a stable phase, which doesn't fluctuate in time, which can be tuned at all these frequencies. This is what people used to call the terahertz gap, which we have conquered. So in principle, what I can do is I can have long pulses, short pulses, narrow, broad, and shape those to drive these excitations the way I want. Okay? So this is a little bit, and there's continuing ongoing work to try to find ways to control these solids. Somehow the vision, I believe, is that now let's assume that I'm exciting phonons in a system, and let's assume that this material has n atoms and 3n modes. In principle, if I have 3n laser beams, in a world in which I can have 3n laser beams, that are all synchronized with one another with the right relationship between phase and amplitude, I can put the atoms where I want. So some theorists can tell me, can you take YBCO, and for a short amount of time, can you make it something else? And in principle, I mean, one question that one could say is, can I take bilayer graphene and make it MGB2, for example? I can move the bands in a certain direction, or I can move the atoms in a certain direction and control the structure. So somehow we're getting at that level of precision. Okay, the second thing that we're going to try to do with the pump is all the experiments that I've told you about up to now. I haven't told you about any experiments, but all the things that are implied by the technique that I have shown you up to now involve the use of short pulses. So at best here, I can have my atom swing back and forth for, 10 times, for a picosecond, a couple of picoseconds. Sometimes what I would like to have is a pulse that has been shaped first, and then is, however, long enough in time. There's work that we're doing. I have nothing to show you other than this is for experiments that I'm not going to tell you about. But for example, one would like to have a pump pulse that is long compared to some relaxation time. Some work we're doing involves using pulses from seed from OPA plus DFG, which now you know what it is, and put them into a CO2 laser. This is a gas laser which can amplify long pulses. And we can now, using a combination of various things, including Pockel cells, we can generate now long pulses at some particular frequency, which then we can slice with light pulses, for example, using plasma mirrors in semiconductors. And we can make pulses of different durations. So this is a 10 micron pulse that can either be from 1 picosecond to, I don't know, many, many hundreds of picoseconds, and we can study systematically how our response depends on the pulse duration. Okay? So much for the pump. This is, so in principle, what we can do now is to drive whichever excitation we want in a system as long as it's at long wavelength. Remember, in condensed matter, of course, you also have wave vectors that can be higher than zero. And unfortunately, this is not something we can do. In the far field, you can only excite things at k equals zero. But to the extent that these excitations are at k equals zero, you can drive them direct. And they have a dipole, and they're odd. You can drive them. What you can't do is, of course, drive totally symmetric modes. And you cannot drive modes at finite frequency. But As long as they're odd and they're k equals zero, I can do what I want with them somehow. Right, okay, the probe. This is an even bigger subject, but the purpose of this talk is just to give you a flavor of what people are trying to do these days, okay? And how, again, these very nice lasers and various other things that I will just very briefly touch on. What time is it? Right, okay, I think I'm talking too slow or talking too much, or both.
Before you switch to the probe.
Yes.
So despite all this fantastic technology that you described,
yeah,
still, if I understand correctly, some windows of frequencies.
So this is now, that's not true. So this paper, which just came out last week, from Bia Long, my student, really shows by using a number of organic crystals and chirp pulses. I mean, I'm not going to get into this. What we used to be able to do is only to excite around here. And this is because we did the difference frequency in one particular type of crystal, which is called gallium selenide or silver gallium selenide. And in all this region, this was the terahertz gap. You can never pump phonons down here. So now we've gotten to the point where we can make narrow pulse or short pulse lasers. So in principle, we could take YBCO or another one of these oxides and excite any phonon we want.
So you now have perps in any
position frequency, with approximately a couple percent bandwidth, 1% bandwidth, of course. And you can even think about pumping below the inhomogeneous line, and do things like hole burning, for example, that has been done in nonlinear spectroscopy. And so, in principle, I think this is really a big deal. We'll see how far we get with this. But in principle, now we can address anything in that spectrum. Before we leave the pump behind us, does anybody have any question, thoughts? Was that clear? Or yeah, okay. Please. Well, provided that there's only phonons there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then what can I do with the power of this pulse?
Yeah. Okay.
Will that influence?
Okay, so let's see. In general, how am I going to answer this? So as you have a field that is only weakly nonlinear, you will drive the phonons, and you can think about the excitations of the phonons in the same way that we thought about the polarization in the nonlinear crystal. And so there's going to be multiple orders in which different phonon modes, for example, will be mixed. This is something that we've worked with Antoine. I see Alaska back there. So there's work, theoretical work being done in trying to understand exactly what happens as you scale up the field of these phonons, but one can think about second order, third order, fourth order phonon nonlinearities, all the way to melting, if you wish. For example, in the organic crystals, we have way too much light, and we can melt them before we can do anything. So in principle, you can drill a hole, I suppose.
That's not exactly your
window. Not necessarily. No, exactly. Yes. So first Michele, and then Alaska, who's in the back. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'm not 100%, okay, the level of reliability of this answer is relatively low, but I believe that the Zener-like effect that you're suggesting is intrinsic to the anharmonicity that I'm thinking of. When I think about how phonon A couples to phonon B, what it means is that the electronic structure is being renormalized by the field, and hence phonon A couples to phonon B, because the electronic structure is going with it. Does this answer your question?
Partly, because in principle, with such a field, you can have a transition between, say, bands that at equilibrium are at frequency much higher than the pump.
I mean, of course, if the ponderomotive energy that is within your field is of order the band gap, you will have Zener tunneling. I mean, all, okay, let me say it in a different way. The fact that a phonon resonance is at a specific frequency is only a property that you have at zero field. Once the field becomes finite, of course, you have broadening of all these lines that all mix up together. But this, you know, this is the life we've chosen, and we're trying to understand how these effects are going to be. So this is all part of this nonlinear response at long wavelengths, I would say. That's Alaska, you had a question, I thought. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you excite all kinds of phonons? What sort of phonons you can excite?
Well, let's say you have 3n odd modes at k equals zero, then you can control the relative phase and the relative amplitude of all these modes. You can do whatever you can with the linear combination of 3n modes. And so you can cover a lot of free space. That's my, you know, of course this is said in jest, because of course you cannot have 3N lasers in YBCO where 3N is 92. But then again, in your computer you probably can. And then one can maybe there's interesting experiments. But you're certainly familiar, for example, with the experiments that Tobias is doing, where he's thinking about using, where he's pumping two modes with relative phases, and then you start making the atoms move around or not, or going linearly. So in a sense, provided that the technology follows you, you could generate many dynamical states that come from this linear superposition. All right, we're going to go through there's so many things that I need to say. So this is going to be a little bit of a phone book or a laundry list now. But let's say that now what I want to do is to use this pulse, which was the pulse that I told you about. And then I want to use at least a second pulse that interrogates this dynamical state as a function of time. Now let's think about 100 years of condensed metaphysics. What people do nowadays at equilibrium is, and this is just a small list of things that people do, they measure the optical spectrum with infrared optics, so they want to have broadband optics, and you can measure particular correlation functions of the system. They measure the spectral function with photoemission. They do ARPIS, or they do XPS, they do core level, they measure chemical shifts, they measure all sorts of things. They measure X-ray absorption, which I haven't shown here. They use scanning tunneling microscopy to measure densities of states or something related to densities of states. You want to measure atomic structure with hard X-rays. You measure magnetic order with, say, resonant X-rays or neutron scattering. And there's another half a dozen techniques. So in principle, if you are a megalomaniac, you may say, okay, what we want, you know, a good strategy is to try to extend as many of these techniques as possible to the ultra-fast timescale, relying on all this beautiful progress. So I'm going to just tell you the things we do. We do three or four of these things. And I'm just going to sort of walk you through a couple of things that can be done. And again, I would really like to meet with any one of you who wants to know more details. This is, for example, the optical spectrum of YBCO, which is a high temperature superconductor. And this is a typical measurement that I do at equilibrium. There are signatures of the superconducting state, in particular this edge here and this other edge here. Let's say these two things. There's multiple phonons, there's various things. People measure those. And what I would like to do is to measure them as a function of time as these things develop, okay? So that's the plan. Here I pump and here I probe. How can I measure such a broad band? Of course, in principle, I could tune my probe laser, you know, and redo the experiment many, many times. What I would like to do is to measure this spectrum and measure this with sensitivity to amplitude and phase, meaning that what I want is both the real and the imaginary part of the optical constants. So the way I can do this is to use a probe pulse with a very broad spectral content. And so let's say a half cycle pulse. If this is a half cycle pulse, this will be a white light pulse with a spectral content that will be approximately the inverse of this pulse duration. And the way I do this, again, let's go back to difference frequency generation. Remember what I told you, there was this difference frequency. There's going to be another slide after this. But let's say I have a pulse in which this is a spectrum, and this pulse has a finite bandwidth. And so what happens is that here I have some green and here I have some yellow. And in principle, I can take difference frequency generation between any pairs of frequencies that are within this spectrum, okay? And another way to see, so this what I will get is a single cycle terahertz pulse that looks like that. Another way to see this is that a pulse, if I look at my second order polarizability, what I know from just basic things that everybody learns in school, if I consider the second order nonlinearity, what I have is a second harmonic and also a term that is a DC term that doesn't oscillate at any frequency. And so this will be a DC term that follows the envelope of the field. Okay? So by optical rectification, what I can get is from second order nonlinear crystals, what I can get is a signal that is related somehow to the envelope of any pulse that I spit in there. Okay, so this is one of the ways to generate terahertz radiation over a large spectrum. Okay, and then the question is, what medium am I using here? What sort of pulses am I using here? This was started in the 1980s by Dave Austin and various other people at Bell Labs. For the last 30 years, people have been trying to optimize this process of generating terahertz radiation. We've actually copied what people do. We haven't done anything new. What I can show you is that by using, for example, plasmas instead of second harmonic radiation, and by mixing first and second harmonic of the pump pulse, we can get a spectrum in a single pulse that covers effectively all the interesting part of the spectrum that we're interested in. Okay, this is nothing special. Other people have done this. It can be copied and it can be applied to an interesting material. So the way this is measured is the following. This is my terahertz probe pulse, and these are effectively three pulse experiments in which I have a pump pulse, which is the one that I told you before that drives the dynamics. Then I have this probe terahertz pulse, and then there is a third pulse that samples the response of the pulse, and in a sense measuring a spectrogram of this pulse at for any pump probe time delay between this and this. So this is a two-dimensional measurement in which at each time delay, I will measure both, you know, this dynamics, and I will measure the spectrum of this pulse by Fourier transforming this time trace. And I will do this with sensitivity to both amplitude and phase. So if I do the things right, I'll be able to pull out epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, or sigma 1 and sigma 2, at every point in time during this dynamics. Again, you will see more in one of these lectures. This is an example of the dynamics in yttrium barium cuprate, in which we were interested in studying how particular features that are related to the superconducting tunneling change as a function of time, and these are fits to the data. This is experimental data taken at various time delays, in which we can really look at a lot of features, how phonons we arrange, how various things we arrange, and again, this comes only because we can generate very broadband terahertz pulses with very short pulses that are generated by this beautiful short pulse amplified laser. And this is an example of wait a second. No, that's not what I wanted to show you, but it doesn't matter. This is an example of again, what I just told you. This is this is sigma 1, and this is sigma 1 in a different frequency range as they evolve in time. Okay? No more said about terahertz. Yes, please.
So the actual measurement is done in time domain?
The actual measurement involves three pulses.
Yes.
No.
That I understood.
Yeah. So you have two delays, right? What you're doing is doesn't matter which thing you're moving. Let's assume there's a pump pulse that is fixed, launches an intrinsic dynamics in the sample. Then you have a second pulse, which was the rectification of da-da-da. And at each time delay here, you scan the sampling pulse, which then tells you how much the electric field is changing at each point along the spectrum and at each point along this dynamics. This is the Fourier transform of a spectral component of the frequency domain probe, and this is the time resolved evolution. How am I doing? Did you get that? Did you get what I said? Doesn't matter. Okay, let's assume the following. Forget about this pulse. You take this pulse, you put it in a spectrometer, and you measure the spectrum as a function of this time delay. Okay, this is just an expensive spectrometer. It doesn't matter. It's a spectrometer that measures amplitude and phase. Okay.
And it's easy to see how you relate amplitude and phase to conductivity. Is there something that's not?
It's relatively simple. I mean, there's what you get is R, small r, as you learn in school, because this is the field reflectance or reflection. And then that comes as a function of time, et cetera, et cetera. So you go through the Fresnel equations and you can figure this out. And of course, you have a time resolution, which is given by the spectral content of this. I mean, of course, the time resolution is not infinite. It's not set by this pulse, but it's set by this pulse. At any rate, this is okay. Right, okay, so this is one of the things that people do. Another thing that people do is, for example, what you want to do is measure atomic rearrangements. This is a huge field. What you would like to do is what people call the molecular movie. You sort of drive the system and then the atoms move and you would like to reconstruct them. I mean, going back to Alaska's question, you're moving 3N atoms and you want to sample them as a function of time. To do this, you would like to use X-rays, for example, to do X-ray diffraction in time. So this is again a very long thing. People have been at it for at least 20 years. So the first experiments that were done used for example, copper or other types of target. People used big lasers, and then with this big laser they would create a microplasma, and then one would use K-alpha radiation to get out. And then would scatter, and this would be done as a functional pump-prompt time delay. The first experiment was done at the LOA, so this is Richel and Antoine Rousse that measured some melting some film together with Jean-Louis Martin. And these are other experiments that we did, for example, by looking at strain as it propagates into crystals. This is now getting too much. You can look at optical. What is going on here? Right. I can't show you this, but these were optical phonons in bismuth. Other techniques we used slicing, for example, at synchrotrons, where one could use femtosecond lasers to slice out short bursts of electrons separated in time from a long electron pulse in a synchrotron, in order to generate femtosecond electron pulses and then do pump probe experiments. This is 5 years of my. This curve. Is 5 years of my life when we try to develop with signal to noise of one, to develop these early techniques until new sources came in line. I mean, these were like really difficult experiments in which one would have, you know, on a synchrotron, one would have a laser on the one side of the synchrotron that would be coupled into the synchrotron slice. Zero photons would come out. I mean, this was really very, very difficult and something that perhaps could not sustain the field much longer until people started using accelerators. Of course, people started making, this is the Stanford LINAC. This is a 3 kilometer LINAC with beams that go to that are accelerated up to 10, say about 15 GeV. And so one can use these pulses they can be made synchronous to a laser and one can start doing experiments. So all of a sudden, all this science has become big science. It used to be tabletop work and now we start using free electron lasers. These are experiments. For example, nowadays, the new generation, these are the free electron lasers. These are effectively, you know, 3 kilometer long accelerators, which, as I said, they generate pulses at about 10 to 20 GeV. And these pulses are you know, they interact. These pulses interact with the photon field bunch and then amplify and create millijoules of X-ray radiation with femtosecond pulses, just to renormalize you. Until about, say, 2010, we humans, Homo sapiens, we were able to make lasers all the way to 80 eV. Nowadays, we can make them to 20 kV. There's a hole in the wall in California, and now in Hamburg, and soon in Switzerland, where you can get millijoules of pulses with femtosecond duration at anywhere you want in the spectrum between 100 eV and 20 kV. This is really a triumph of I don't know what, of big science and accelerator technology. So these can be synchronized to a laser to study the molecular movie or the motion of the atoms. These are experiments that I will tell you about. This is work done in collaboration with Antoine's group in Alaska and my student Roman Mankowski, in which we looked at the transient lattice distortions induced in a YBCO crystal by the excitation of one particular phonon, which then would couple to multiple other phonons and create a transient structural distortion that would give rise to important changes of the electronic properties, in particular enhancing the coherence of these and creating some features of the superconducting state above the equilibrium transition temperature. So this is how we could, by a combination of measuring a few peaks and by theory, we could make a proposal for a transient crystal structure of a putative enhanced superconducting state, a system with a higher transient superconducting state. Other things that one can do with these free electron lasers, again, I'm walking a little fast here, are experiments in the soft X-rays, in which nowadays one measures all the spins by doing resonant soft X-ray diffraction. This is something that became available at synchrotrons statically only 10 years, maybe say 15 years ago. And nowadays with free electron lasers, we do this routinely at femtosecond resolution. These are experiments in which one looks at, for example, charge stripes in some other cuprates. These are things that my group has been involved in which we can measure the melting of charge stripes. Just to give you an idea, what we're doing is we're using short X-ray pulses to reconstruct super lattices of charge modulation on top of the lattice of, say, less than a tenth of an atom of an electron per atom. And this is done as a function of time with femtosecond resolution and on nanometer length scales. If you think about what was being done 15 years ago even when I was a postdoc, this is just a completely different world. I mean, this is really how technology is opening up all sorts of unbelievable things to do. Last thing that I'm going to tell you, again, no details, but just to give you the flavor of what can be done nowadays, is this. In principle, what you would like to do is to measure how inhomogeneous patterns. Now, in the other experiment, what I showed you were experiments in which you would look at some particular periodicity, and you would look at some Bragg peak as a function of time, and you would measure that. In principle, you would like to look at aperiodic structures and reconstruct an object. And you can do this, of course, if you phase this diffraction pattern. If you measure a diffraction pattern and you only measure the modulus, of course, you'll get the modulus of the Fourier transform, which can be Beck Fourier transform to give you an autocorrelation of the object that you want to look at, but not the object itself. So in principle, what one needs to do is to take diffraction from some of these patterns, for example, and phase them. What people are doing nowadays is to apply holographic methods. So in principle, you can use a free electron laser that is transversely coherent. You can have an object and a second hole. Let these guys interfere in the far field, and you can phase this diffraction pattern, like in holography. You can use a reference beam and the object to reconstruct your object. These are experiments that we did with Henry Chapman, where we put some, I don't know what this thing was, some elephant on a silicon nitride pattern, and we could explode them as a function of time and reconstruct them as these things were evolving, and we're trying to develop new techniques. Okay, I'm done with this. There's many things that I haven't told you, and again, this is a highly skewed view of what's being done. Some experiments that are done in my department, there's a lot of work using XUV radiation for femtosecond ARPIS. We've done some work in graphene and various decalcogenides. Sebastian Loth in my department, this is not work I'm in any way involved in, but he's working on this, is to use STM gated by a terahertz pulse. Normally when you do STM, what you do is you apply a DC field and you try to look at the tunneling, which is of course not very specific in time. What Sebastian is doing, he has a very successful ERC to do this. He's using a terahertz pulse in order to apply the gate at one point in time and only suck the tunneling current in one particular point in time. Other work, this is again, we've taken stuff that was done in the 1980s, but then never really developed. And we use what are called Austin switches. These are photoconductive switches, which can be switched on and switched on for only, say, a fraction of a picosecond, and we can launch current pulses that propagates through waveguides. And in principle, one of the things we're trying to do is to build squids with fast time resolution, things of this nature, measure transport at short times. So everything that I've told you has been done by these beautiful group of people. Let's see, I wanted to show, so Yannis actually, who's just, I broke my heart, he didn't come to my lecture, was with me and he's now at Polytechnique and he's just come back to Paris. Whose work did I talk about? I talked a lot about the work of Bia Long, which I can't see. There you go. Bia Long, Liu, and Michel First, who have really done a lot to develop these optical parametric amplifiers. Andrea Cartella also. Daniele Nicoletti, of course, Roman, who did all this X-ray analysis. Van Zheng Hu, who developed the broadband terahertz work for the YBCO. Matteo Mitrano, I haven't told you anything about him, but he's been really doing a lot on these things. And lots of other things and people. So I'm going to, I think I spoke for too long and I apologize for this. This is some sort of summary of what I've told you. I did warn you that this was going to be a hysteric combination of no information and too much information. But I hope at least I gave you the flavor of some of the things that can be done. Thank you for your attention.